Aloha, kakayaka. Now kind of here with Nalio Hawaiian Issues coming right up. And Nalio Hawaiian Issues is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Kawa Kauai, Tahiti Nui Luau, and Hanalei Gourmet.
Kawa Kauai is pleased to support Nalio Hawaiian Issues, a family-operated business serving traditional kawa on Kauai for over 15 years. Available at Harvest Market, Healthy Hut, Papayas, and Hoku Whole Foods. More information at 1-800-626-0883 or online at realkawa.com. Kawa, the drink of peace.
Announcing the return of the Tahiti Nui's Hanalei Luau, featuring 50 years of songs and dances as a tribute to their mama, Auntie Louise. Tahiti Nui, providing live Hawaiian music on Kauai since 1963. This family-style luau is every Wednesday, 5 to 7:30. More information at 826-6277 or online at thenui.com.
The Hanalei Gourmet, where they serve lunch and dinner 7 days a week in the old schoolhouse in Hanalei Town, is proud to underwrite Kauai Community Radio.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. Stay tuned for Nalayo Hawaiian Issues. And we have in-house Mr. Keanu Sai, Shane Cobb Adams, and I forgot your name, but we're going to get you in the...
Lorenz Goncho.
So stay tuned for Nalayo Hawaiian Issues.
Ai no ke aku la iu ke mai le pu ani te wai hina kai lun ka mahu kai la lo ka lu o ka le o e mai o mai u le o ke i te te wai wai ai I kea kaukini e lawai e manu kaupena i tuku i te anoe o kopo kahi ke ho punia e la te ohu o nā ki kepa kena i ela i te luna o ka uwana he uahi he ka o peku peku e e i te i manu o O puoli, ke ali I uale no te au maki maki, ka luhi o I a maua me ienei, o ko mako ule ale no I. Ai.
You need, yeah. Trying to take what the Kanaka Maoli got,
yeah.
Just to satisfy the government's greed. Hawaiians, tell me what you want,
yeah.
Kanaka Maoli, tell me what you need,
yeah.
We must never forget what our kupuna taught,
yeah.
Even if I have to bleed. The educator, mana go deeper than a crater. You should have known, mana, that I'll be back sooner or later. With even greater, mana, you know they didn't wanna ever go down while they see us rising like an elevator. But it's time for the indigenous uprise. I see the fire burning in the children's eyes. Another freeway, another hayah dies. It's time to make the government joke on their lies. The term Hawaiian homes is a joke to me, cause every piece of land is Hawaiian homes to me. But it ought to be a residential, blood must be 50%. Whoever thought of that law is an idiot to me. So we're living on the beach and you call us squatters, because we're living off our own land, fishing from our own waters. I promise our fight will never be over, just try and run us over with your damn bulldozer. I rap for my people, I cry for my people, I live for my people, I die for my people. What you see is what you get, take me as I am, and I ain't never had an uncle named Sam. To all my people, tell me what you want,
yeah.
Hawaiians, tell me what you need,
yeah.
Trying to take what the Kanaka Maoli got,
yeah.
Just to satisfy the government's greed. Hawaiians, tell me what you want,
yeah.
Kanaka Maoli, tell me what you need,
yeah.
We must never forget what our kupuna taught,
yeah.
Even if I have to bleed.
Hey, you didn't think it's a battle zone, but it's damn sure right, cause it's your
own.
When I prepare to fight, I reminisce about the past and the present.
You guys all know that's our theme song, and I usually like play it too because I love Sudden Rush and AR. But we're going to talk about AR today. Sovereignty, independence. And like we've been talking about for the whole year since the DOI meetings, you know, we saw the people come out in force, spoke their minds. We know we have distractors on the side, but we know they're a minority. We We know that the majority of the people came out and spoke the truth. So now how do we organize and go forward? And as we have in-house, and I'll have them introduce themselves, because you guys heard me enough every week. Let's introduce our guests, our special guests here in Nalea Hawaiian Issues. Anyone want to take the mic first?
Aloha kākou. My name is Shane Cobb Adams. We just put together a halawai kuokoa last night at Wilcox, for those of you who couldn't make it. And there'll be a series of educational events, one per month for the next 6 months, that Hui Aloha Aina Okoe will be putting on. But last night's guest speakers were Dr. David Kanosai, who's here with us today.
Hey, aloha.
And Lawrence Gonshore, who is a PhD candidate in the Department of Political Science, doing critical research related to the history of the Hawaiian Kingdom and the history of Hawaiian Kingdom law.
Aloha.
So I think last night's halawai was actually pretty awesome. We had about 100 people there at Wilcox Elementary. And we can, if you want, we can start with kind of going through some of the questions that we didn't get to at the halawai.
Cool, like I told you before, you have 2 hours to see what you like. Wait, that's right. We got to do this part. I think you guys might have heard this kind before.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Basically, that means we covered. So, yes, gentlemen, you have the floor. And again, we have to apologize to everyone out there. Our phone lines are down right now. So we're going to do this in-house. But we have a lot of knowledge in here, so I don't think we're going to have to worry about what we have to say. So, Shane, take it away. It's all yours.
All right. We'll just pick up where we left off last night at the Halawai Kuokoa with some questions that audience members had. And so this one, I think maybe Ken or Lawrence can answer. The question was, the U.S. government recognizes a 2,000-year-old sovereignty claim of Israel, but not the 122-year-old claims of Hawaii. Why?
Okay. Well, that's an interesting question.
It is, huh?
Yeah. Actually, the sovereignty claim for Israel is actually not necessarily sovereignty, because Israel started in the 1940s, but it goes back to King David. So I think that's what they're referring to, yeah, the 2,000-year aspect. Why is it that the United States is not recognizing the sovereignty of the Hawaiian Kingdom? Actually, it is, and it did.
Yeah. Through treaties.
Yeah, so the United States formally recognized Hawaii as an independent state, which is recognized its sovereignty, 1844. Okay, July 6th. So Secretary of State John C. Calhoun notifies the Hawaiian government that the President of the United States, President Tyler, fully recognizes Hawaii's independence. Now, once you recognize the independence of a state, okay, you're recognizing that only Hawaiian law applies over that territory. So by the United States recognizing Hawaii's sovereignty, they're saying that for American citizens who travel to Hawaii, they're subject to Hawaiian law. And for Hawaiian subjects traveling to America, they are subject to American law.
Can you rescind that recognition?
No. Once you recognize a sovereign state, you can't de-recognize it. What you've just done is given birth to a country. Okay. So once the Hawaiian Kingdom became a state, it has sovereignty, but it exercises that sovereignty through a government. Now, a government is different from a state. So government is based upon diplomatic recognition, not international recognition of sovereignty. So you can de-recognize a government, which is withdrawing diplomatic recognition, but that doesn't equate to the non-recognition of the country. So an example of that would be Cuba. Okay, so in the case of America and Cuba, it's Cuban relations. Cuba is a sovereign state since early 1900s, right? Now, once Castro took over that government, the United States withdrew recognition of that government. But by withdrawing the recognition of the government, which is diplomatic recognition, or withdrawing diplomatic recognition, that did not mean Cuba ceased to exist as a sovereign state.
So they couldn't withdraw their recognition of Cuba as an international state and a matter of international law.
Yeah.
So in some ways, the question is kind of, well, not misleading, but challenging and somewhat erroneous, because the 2,000-year-old claim of Israelis is not to sovereignty, but maybe more aptly described as self-determination, which was exercised in the 40s.
Well, the issue of Israel is a complex issue because actually Israel was situated in a place called Palestine. And Palestine was a mandate territory that used to be part of the Ottoman Empire. So after World War I, Palestine was assigned to the British as an administrator to facilitate self-determination for Palestine to become an independent state. After World War II, you had what is called the Zionist movement, and a lot of the Jewish people were moving from Europe into the area called Palestine. And thus you have a buildup of where we are today. And Israel declared itself to be Israel, not Palestine, based upon the origin of King David. Okay, but that is more religious.
Right? Yeah.
So it's not international law. Yeah. So for Israel to declare their independence, it was then recognized, and then you have a situation here between Palestinian self-determination and Israelis who exercise their self-determination in creating the Israeli state, and then you have an issue there.
Yeah. Well, see, and that's an interesting situation to me because it seems analogous to, in some ways, the Kingdom of Atu'i's claim based on a religious order in the past. But where do you distinguish between sovereignty, the religious order, and really the declaration of self-determination?
Well, I mean, if I could just chime in here, I think that there's a basic difference where we're pretty much talking about two completely different kind of ideas here. One is international law and sovereignty. And, you know, if you compare, let's say, Hawaii to Israel, as a sovereign independent state, Hawaii starts in 1843 and Israel starts in 1949 or 48, like after World War II. But, of course, in both countries you have a long, let's call it native tradition of statecraft that goes, you know, very, very, very long back in time. And so in Hawaii you have the four kingdoms. Prior to Kamehameha you get the Hawaii Island Kingdom, on which the Hawaiian Kingdom is based, and that goes back at least, I would say, 800-900 years prior to that, you know, the time of, you got Umialiloa, but even before you got people like Kalaunui Ohua, you got all the way to the Ulu and Nana Ulu line. So you get like all these genealogies going back to kind of a tradition of statecraft. And that's kind of, that would be analogous, I guess, to an Israeli Jewish tradition of statecraft going back all the way to King David or even prior to that. So, but again, in terms of international law is a kind of pretty recent phenomenon in world history. It goes pretty much back to at the earliest 1600s with the Treaty of Westphalia, and then you get like, you know, slowly it extends from there to the rest of the world. It incorporates other places, and as I said, Hawaii joined that system of international law in 1843. Israel joined it by becoming independent, you know, within the territory formerly claimed by the British Empire in the 1940s. So, I guess.
And so that kind of brings up a question. Could you have a descendant of David, now a lineal descendant, claiming to be the king of Israel?
Well, that is a question for Israeli history and Israeli.
Well, let's take the state. Hawaiian version. Could you have a descendant of one of the great chiefs of antiquity declaring himself the mo'i and religious head of the kingdom?
No. And the reason is because Hawaii by 1840 was a constitutional system, constitutional government. That's the key. So the Hawaiian kingdom as a constitutional system provided an office that used to be in the seat of the person. So during the time of Kamehameha, the first, he was not just the government, but he was Ali'inui, he was the king. His son, Kamehameha III, when he established the Constitution of 1840, basically created a body corporate separate from the king. And that body corporate was created by the Constitution. It's like creating a corporation. You now have a CEO and not a private person running a company. And that office is regulated by a system of laws called the organic law. So in the Hawaiian kingdom, as far as the monarch by 1864 was referred to as the executive monarch. where you had the three branches of government, separate and distinct: legislature, judicial, executive. The monarch, by 1864, was solely the executive authority that carries out the law, the executive power. If a monarch, according to Hawaiian law, does not appoint a successor who needs to be confirmed by the nobles, then the legislature will kick in and they would have to elect by ballot a successor. So in this case for Hawaii, when King Kamehameha V passed away without naming a successor to that executive monarch, the legislature convened in special session and elected King Lunalilo, William Charles Lunalilo. Lunalilo served for about a year. He passed away. He didn't name a successor. So the legislature reconvened again in special session, and they elected King David Kalakaua. Now, King David Kalakaua named as his successor William Pitt Leleahoku, which is his brother. But his brother passed away, and then he appointed, after, Princess Liliʻuokalani as his successor. And she received confirmation hearings from the nobles. Now, one of the provisions of checks and balances in the Hawaiian Kingdom Constitution, Article 24 of the Hawaiian Constitution, says no one shall sit upon the throne who has been convicted of an infamous crime, insane, or an idiot. Okay, and these are the words that were used. What that means is, when the successor is nominated by the monarch, the nobles will confirm or reject based upon that standard.
They will. So look if into, he's an idiot, they can reject him.
Yes. Yeah. But idiot is actually a legal term. It's not a derogatory term.
It just means mentally ill.
It just means psychologically ill.
Yeah, and you actually have to file a complaint in a court to prove. You have to actually, in the Hawaiian Kingdom, actually have to file a court case to prove that somebody's an idiot. Hmm. So there's actually a process for that. But what...
They put them up there and they kind of implicate themselves.
Yeah. But what the nobles do is they look at that and determine whether or not the person has been convicted of an infamous crime, which is a felony. Right. If so, can't be. They can't confirm the nomination. If the person is insane, okay, and they have a medical doctor that can attest to that, no, they're not going to approve the nomination. If the person is an idiot, after being proven to be an idiot in a court proceeding, because due process, they won't confirm. So when Liliʻuokalani was appointed or nominated and confirmed by the nobles, she was able to. Meet the standard.
Pass that bar.
Pass that bar.
She met the mustard.
Now, after Liliʻuokalani, after Kalakaua was elected as king, what's important to know is Kalakaua is not from the Kamehameha line.
Yeah, there was a dynastic change at that point.
Exactly. It's called a new stirps. That's the term that's used in the Hawaiian Constitution. Okay. So actually, Kalakaua comes from Kamanawa, one of the chiefs of Kamehameha. Okay. Right. But they're all from the Kingdom of Hawaii, the Hawaii Kingdom. Not the Kingdom of Maui, and not the Kingdom of Kauai.
And not the Kingdom of Atui.
Well, Atui is not even a Hawaiian word. Yeah, that's
exactly.
An English word.
Yeah. Exactly. It's how the English heard...
British phonetics.
Yeah, so they're pronouncing it as a Hawaiian word, but it's not.
No, it's not even Hawaiian. No, and it's actually British. So Atui, as we pronounce it here, that's with the American phonics. Actually, you're supposed to pronounce it with British phonics, because it was a British subject that wrote it. So when you have two vowels together, two O's, you don't say ooh,
say
you say o-oi, o-oi, or a-o, or o-ao, something like that. Mm-hmm. So basically, you would pronounce ato-oi, Tawai. So it was a British guy listening to somebody from Kauai trying to say, this is where I live. This is the island. Atoai. Tawai.
Well, probably with the O, like with the particle O in front of it. O Tawai, like what's the name of the end?
O Tawai. Because O provides the place.
And if you get O Tawai and then you transcribe it without knowing...
What was the name of Cook's cartographer that
Weber.
Made that map?
Weber.
That was Weber.
Yeah. So the notion that this word, A-T-O-O-I, is a Hawaiian word, it's not.
Yeah, and you look on the maps, and that's how you can tell how they were phonetically pronouncing, because O-Y-H-E, O-W-E.
Exactly.
Right. So yeah, like said, it's not A-T-U-I, it's probably, we don't know exactly, but probably close to A-T-U-I, like you said.
Right. You know, there's another, and I brought this up last night, and Lawrence brought this up as well. The standardization of the language was not done until after 1820s, okay? Cook arrived here in 1878. Okay. So it wasn't standardized. But in
1778.
Sorry. But Kamehameha actually wrote a letter to King George III in 1810. Okay? And he actually signed it. He has his signature. And if you would look at it at first, it looks like Tamaama'a.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? T-A-M-A-H-M-A-H. But you have the two vowels, the two A's. You don't pronounce it the same. You actually offset it. So you actually pronounce it Tamaama'a. But that's the British phonics that's pronouncing that. That's not the standardized Hawaiian that we've come to know today. So the language did evolve from oral to written.
And actually, what I was taught too is that if you're on the windward side, like when Kamehameha's caskets came back second, it was written Tamehameha. Mm. And they concluded that it was a certain guy from this side of the island who used more T's and K's. Yeah. Like you said, it wasn't standardized. If you were on windward side, you might have spoke a little bit different from Kekala side.
It was very dialectical. In fact, my cousin Kiao Nee Smith is a PhD linguist, and he reckons each valley in Ahupua had a slightly slightly different dialect from valley to valley.
Well, let's take that same concept today here in Hawaii. Okay, so, you know, shave ice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so people say, hey, I eat shave ice at Haleiwa. But if you're from Hilo, you call it ice shave. No, I'm serious. So it's a dialect. So we still have that today in the English language.
Different flavors, too, and you might get goody goody beans, you might not.
Yeah, and Lake Tahoe, you call it snow.
You know, so we need to understand things in the context of that time and not judge yesterday by today's standard because you're making certain assumptions that you know what's going on. You need to allow history to tell you what happened. So what I shared last night is the practical value of history is that it's a film of the past run through the projector of today onto the screen of tomorrow. That film never changes, but your projector has to get updated. Once you update your projector, you can process more film. Now you see something that you didn't see before. And that's why what we're going through here is recovering memory. Yeah, it's through research. And both myself and Lawrence, we're from the University of Hawaii. Both, he's in political science. My PhD is in political science. And it's research that is really beginning to change the terrain. And it is actually challenging the paradigm and the thought process and the conclusions that we've come to. There is a term called assumption, yeah, as opposed to presumption. So assumption comes from the word assume. Okay, an assumption is a conclusion without facts. That's why people refer to assume as ask you me, assume, right? But if you presume, that is a conclusion based upon facts, like the presumption of innocence. You're presumed innocent because you have rights. That's why you're presumed to be innocent. You don't have to prove it. The other party has to prove you're guilty, right? So we are now venturing into the presumption arena where the conclusions need to be based upon facts and not based upon no facts, which leads to argument. Yeah? See, then you're getting more political. Now you're talking about what we ought to do. Well, before you can get into what you ought to do, can you explain to me what happened?
Exactly.
You know, because right now you're talking baseball and I'm talking football. And you're trying to tell me I need to hit a home run in a football game. You know, let's get to the theory first. Let's find out which game are we playing here. And it's not an argument. It is what it is. So at the university, within scholarship, which we call research, you're not up there before your doctoral committee or before your master's thesis committee to argue your research. You actually have to defend your research. You don't argue. Leave that up to the people outside. You defend it and you base it upon evidence. You base it upon theory, methodology, all these little things that basically teases out these issues. And the one thing that political science that I'm a part of in the legal aspect, it's called intertemporality. Okay, so intertemporality or space and time is that if you're going to understand something that happened in 1848, that event, you need to understand what informed the decision makers of that particular event. Yeah, that way you allow that time frame to tell you what was going on. You don't infuse your ideas into what you think they're doing. So if I'm going to understand the Great Mahele, I need to understand what informed the Privy Council in making the Great Mahele. And it's all there in the Privy Council records. They actually relied on Blackstone's commentaries. They're talking about it. Even Matayo Kekuanao, the chief, they're talking about Blackstone. When they asked William Lee, the Chief Justice, where can we look at as a precedence for the Mahele, he did his research and he came back to the Privy Council the following day and he said Prussia. They're using Prussia as an example of when the commoners acquired title from the nobles in Prussia. So you can see that the Hawaiian Kingdom was very eclectic, and to make decisions, they didn't just rely on a native view. They relied on what works and what doesn't work because we're looking into the future. And I think that speaks to how worldly Hawaii really was. And for Hawaii to have been recognized as an independent state, what people don't realize is that that was very profound, because the European countries and the former European countries like America, Mexico, because that's Spanish, British, you know, if you were European, you could be brought into the family of nations as an independent state. If you're not European, you're not in. So Japan, China, Ottoman Turks, Persia, Iran, they were countries, but they weren't brought into the family of nations. They were kept out purposely. Argument of you're not civilized enough, you don't have the right religion, whatever the case may be.
Well, it's power.
Well, the issue of why they weren't brought in was because their legal system was not looked upon by Europeans as being at a certain level.
It wasn't compatible at that point.
Well, what they wanted to make sure was if a British subject is in Iran, called Persia, that person will be afforded equal protection of the law. So it's really a rule of law. It's part of that positivist
movement. That would imply a treaty to protect that person, correct?
No, not necessarily. You don't need a treaty. But if you recognize that country as being independent, Great Britain is saying only Japanese law or Iranian law applies there, which would apply to their British subjects. You don't need to have a treaty for that. You just need to have them recognized as an independent state. Now, for Hawaii, in 1843, we were the only non-European country to be brought into the family of nations.
The very first.
As a full equal. Absolutely. The first one.
The first guys to puka true.
The other non-European countries, such as Japan, China, did not enter the family of nations until the latter part of the 19th century, 1890s, to the early part of the 20th
Wasn't
century.
Wasn't it the Ottoman Empire that came next? After Hawaii, 1854, maybe?
Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was brought in, but it wasn't recognized as being fully independent. It was after the Crimean War.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, you know, at that, I just let you guys know, we have the legal stuff we got to do, yeah? So at the half hour, we'll be taking a short break, and then we'll get back to our very, very interesting conversation with Shane Cobb Adams. Mr. and Doctor, you get two titles, yeah? Keanu Sai, and I hope I don't butcher your name, Lorenz?
Gonscher.
German?
German, yes.
Oh, okay. Sprechen Sie Deutsch?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back, okay? Let's see what's happening with the island calendar today here on Kauai.
The Hawaiian Music Calendar is supported by HawaiianMusicStore.com. Mahalo, HawaiianMusicStore.com, for your support.
Aloha kakahi a kakako. Welcome to our Hawaiian music calendar for Saturdays. On the North Shore, the Tiki and Niki Restaurant in Princeville Shopping Center presents CAM from 6 to 8. The Tahiti Nui in Hanalei features Jeff Caldwell from 6:30 to 9. The St. Regis Hotel in Princeville features Keili'i Kanili'i from 6:30 to 9:30. On the South Shore, Leilani Rivera Lowe and Halau Hula O Leilani are at the Grand Hyatt in Po'epu from 6 to 9. Keoki's Paradise in the Po'epu Shopping Center presents Moku and Lenny at 6:30. Merriman's Fish House at the Kukui'ula Shopping Center in Po'epu features Kirby Keo at the front mall entrance facing the lanai. He's on the lanai there from 6 to 8. On the east side, there's a free hula show featuring Leilani Rivera Lowe and Halau Hula O Leilani at the Coconut Marketplace Shopping Center at 1 p.m. The Hukilau Lanai at the Kauai Coast Resort in Waipoli presents Billy Paul from 6 to 9. Shutter's Lounge at the Kauai Beach Resort presents Jonah Cummings from 7 to 10. The Eastside Cafe in Okapa'atau presents Hawaiian music from 7 to 9. The Courtyard Kauai Marriott Resort at Waipoli features John Planis from 6:30 to 8:30. And Larry Rivera is featured at the Kauai Museum in Lihue from 1 to 2 with talk, story, and music. On our west side, the Wrangler Steakhouse in Waimea presents Nick Castillo from 6 to 8. If you have Hawaiian music events you'd like posted on our Hawaiian music calendar, please fax it at least 1 week before the event to 826-7977 or email it to events@kkcr.org. Attention, Linda. Mahalo nui loa. Have a great Hawaiian day.
Aloha again. We are back on air with Shane Cobb Adams, Lorenz Gonza. Gunzer. I'll get that one of these days. Mr. Keanu Sai, and we have Bob Sitkoff over here, and we'll just continue the discussion, gentlemen.
One question I have is if you could explain international law during the late 1800s.
Well, good question. Okay, so if we look at international law, we need to first of all realize that what is international law first? Okay, so the term international law centers on the word inter. So inter means between. Yeah? So international law is literally the law between nations. Okay, that's important. The law between nations. So you have sovereign states that exist independent of each other, yeah, under their own legal system. These sovereign states can enter into agreements, yeah, between each other called treaties. So the highest source of international law is a treaty or convention, which is the evidence of an agreement. Okay, that's the number one source of international law, because on the international plane, you don't have a legislature that creates laws. Yeah. Countries create laws that bind themselves to treaties. The second...
So in a sense, then, it's contract law.
Because it signifies consent. So if it's between, that means there's duality there.
And it's bilateral.
It's bilateral. So you have to have an agreement. So I'll give you an example of how a treaty works under international law that reflects this process. So if two countries have their diplomats, they meet at a certain city, and they're going to negotiate a trade agreement, okay? They're going to come to terms on what is something written, right? Both sides. But that doesn't make it international law yet. What they have to do is take that draft, and each has to go back to their governments to get approval.
Ratification.
Okay? And that's called ratification. Under the United States law, you need 2/3 of the senators to vote for that, okay, to approve, which is to ratify an agreement. But at that point, that's still not international law yet.
What was the requirement under Hawaiian Kingdom law for ratification?
The Hawaiian cabinet. Yeah. Not the legislature.
The cabinet approves.
But in the Hawaiian Kingdom, but if a treaty deals with trade or commerce or anything that affects the internal matters of the country, you need legislative approval first. But if it's strictly dealing with things outside of the Hawaiian Kingdom, yeah, like setting up envoys, that comes strictly from the cabinet. Now, where I left off, the second step is you need to get ratification, approval from both countries. But at this stage, it's still not international law yet until the third stage is completed. That's when these envoys will meet at another designated point, whether it's the same city they met at before. And what they would do is they would exchange ratifications. That way, each side will know you agreed. That's when the treaty comes into force. So that's a reflection of international law.
And these are the documents that you find in the state archives, these like really fancy kind of parchment written treaties with these huge national seals on top of them. These are the actual ratification documents that were exchanged. So that's why we get that really fancy ones from all these foreign countries, whereas those in their national archives have the fancy ones from Hawaii with the Hawaiian coat of arms on it and everything.
So both countries have to sign willingly, and until they do that, it's not really...
They need to approve what was signed and then exchange what was approved. So there is no doubt the other side knows that you agree. Now, the second source of international law is what is called custom. customary international law. Now, customary international law is where all the countries of the family of nations, the independent states, not the world of nations, but the independent states, accept amongst each other that these are binding customs.
Is right? that like admiralty law?
No, no. Admiralty law just deals with commercial trade over the high seas.
And that's driven by treaties.
Yeah, treaties, right. But customary, an example of customary international law would be diplomatic immunity. So a diplomat in a foreign country has diplomatic immunity. You can't arrest him. There's no treaty that says he has diplomatic immunity. That is a custom recognized by all the countries as being binding.
Really?
Yeah. So that's a part of customary international
law. I would have thought that they'd have a treaty and they'd have written that down.
Well, here's the source of the diplomatic immunity. Long time ago, probably 1600s, after 1648, two countries are at war with each other in Europe. One of the kings sends over a soldier to negotiate peace, and they kill him. Well, and then they send another one to kill him. And the guy's trying to say, hey, stop. I'm trying to negotiate a surrender. Stop killing.
Stop shooting the messenger.
Yeah, stop shooting the messenger.
Who will I go next?
So what probably came up... So then, if there is some indication that this is a diplomat that's going to negotiate, then he is received, they negotiate, and then it terminates the conflict. So that grew into a custom. So it starts off with mistakes, and then people go, oh, okay, I got it.
Don't shoot the messenger.
Don't shoot the messenger. Now, the third source of international law, this is in precedence law. You got treaties, custom. The third one is principles. Principles from civilized countries. Now, people might get caught up on, ooh, civilized. So who's uncivilized? That's not how civilized states were looked at. Civilized states is a principle where rule of law, okay? The binding nature of a contract called a treaty. That's a principle of countries that deal with contract law. Mm. Well, they would take that same principle and apply it to a treaty. So that's the third source of international law. The fourth source, which is the interpretation of international law, are decisions by international courts. Okay, you can use that to help explain what is international law. Sort of like case law, within the American system. And the final source of international law, the fifth source, is the writings of recognized publicists of other nations.
Mm, like so Oppenheim.
Oppenheim, Ian Brownlee, James Crawford.
Crawford's one of those guys.
Yeah. Yeah. So when they write, you can cite that. So you actually see court cases cite these publicists in explaining what is customary international law. Yeah. So those are the sources of international law. Now, national law only applies to the territory of the entity that created it. Okay, also called domestic law. So the United States has what is called national laws that include statutes and joint resolutions, as well as court cases. Now, not every country recognizes court cases as law. So like in Europe, which has a civil law tradition, they don't recognize court cases as binding law. They only recognize the legislature passing law. But in America, which is a common law system, not a civil law tradition, but common law, court cases are recognized. So an example of a court case in American law that's recognized as law is a court case like Roe versus Wade.
Okay. Yeah, and that sets the precedent.
Exactly.
Right. Until the Congress passes a law to override that. Until then, that becomes a law. But in Switzerland, a court and its decision, like a Roe versus Wade, wouldn't be considered law. Yeah. So each country is different. Yeah. You kind of just use a broad brush. And
what was the Hawaiian Kingdom?
The Hawaiian Kingdom was more of a hybrid. It adopted civil law traditions as well as common law, but it was a common law system because Hawaii traces its legal system back to ancient days, but also includes Great Britain because Hawaii was part of the British Empire since 1794. That's why if you notice the flag, it has the Union Jack in it. Hawaii was not a colony of Great Britain. Actually, Hawaii was part of the British Empire.
And it was Kamehameha that made it so.
Kamehameha I entered into an agreement with Captain Vancouver in 1794, joining the British Empire. And actually, Kamehameha referred to himself and the chiefs as British subjects.
Yeah, and some people are shocked at that, but it was Kamehameha recognizing these as a warrior. these guys have superior weapons.
I want to be with those guys.
Yeah, I cannot fight these guys, and I know other guys like them are coming. I have to form some kind of alliance, and he saw that the only way to protect his people at that time.
Well, actually, he didn't necessarily do it because of foreigners. Sure enough, it was on his mind.
Mm-hmm.
According to the records in the ship log of Vancouver, when they're discussing the issue of ceding the Kingdom of Hawaii, Hawaii Island, to Great Britain and joining the British Empire, K.L. Moku, in particular, he is the father of Kahumanu. Mm-hmm. K.L. Moku, he was in favor of the joining of the British Empire because he was concerned about the attacks coming from the leeward kingdoms. He was referring to the Kingdom of Maui and Kauai, which at that time was Kaikili and Kaeo.
Yeah. True, there's still warfare.
So K.L. Moku was saying, okay, we're part of the British Empire. Give us more guns because we have to repel the leeward kingdom. So they weren't necessarily concerned about foreign invasion. They were more concerned about...
Because
they
were still separate kingdoms.
All in themselves. They were separate kingdoms. And that's why what's really important is when you look at the ship log, you actually get to see what they were saying at that particular time. And it's pretty interesting. I mean, they were very sophisticated. You know, they weren't warriors. I mean, they were statesmen and warriors. Almost like you're looking at King Richard during the Middle Ages. Mm. You know, that's how they were. And you're going, wow. Kamehameha was, that brother was like, hey, he was on it. You know, but I think we kind of downplay it. We make it as if, oh, they're competing against Western civilization. He didn't care about Western civilization. He was concerned about
invasion.
He had
his own problems right at home.
Because they were not united yet.
Getting back to the international law thing, I had a question. So something in international law like the doctrine of self-help, right, which is like the, whenever you see that term, doctrine of self-help,
where do these doctrines
come from? So those are those within international law, or those theories kind of reported by people like Oppenheim?
Okay, so there's a difference between what is called international law, which I spoke about, and international relations. Now, international relations are political, right? International law is legal. Yeah, if there's a contract, there's a treaty.
Roger.
Now, if you're going to have a relationship with another country, that's based upon relationship. Now, there, when you speak of self-preservation, self-help, self-interest that countries have, that's actually it comes from a theory called realism. Okay, Hans Morgenthau is pretty much credited as the person that speaks to realism. Okay, now realism came about after World War II. Prior to World War II, you had what is called the utopian theory. The Wilsonian, Woodrow Wilson. Mm. He was promoting harmony, the League of Nations. Let's get together and work together. But after World War II, they realized that didn't work because it allowed Hitler to rise, which World War II broke out. After World War II, people are reassessing the idea of theory at the international relation level, and Hans Morgenthau was promoting this idea of realism, where countries will only do something if there is self-interest, self-help, or self-preservation. That is post-World War II. Okay, so that created an independence of countries, and who is the leader of realist theory? The United States of America. They are very territorial as far as their authority to ensure that they are protecting themselves, so they don't necessarily adhere to the International Court of Justice because they don't like a bunch of judges making decisions for them because they're sovereign. And Hans Morgenthau is actually American. He's an American theorist.
Yeah.
Henry Kissinger is another example of realist theory. Yeah. So
but
that's not
the
just
Americans
them.
Signed on to the ICJ. They just haven't signed on to the ICC.
Yeah, well, the United States created the International Court of Justice because it's a member of the United Nations.
Mm.
Okay, so everybody pays their UN dues that maintain the court. But when they initially started the International Court of Justice, they asked countries to sign a declaration saying that this court has compulsory jurisdiction over disputes between the states. Who was that? This is... the Nicaraguan case. Schultz. Schultz was, I believe, the Secretary of State at that time. Mm-hmm. And he actually withdrew the compulsory jurisdiction, because Nicaragua filed a lawsuit in the International Court of Justice against the United States because the CIA was setting up mines in the harbor.
Yeah.
And the case went on without the United States participating in it. And then after that, they withdrew the compulsory jurisdiction. So they pick and choose when the court has authority to make decisions that affect them. But if it's in a treaty that says the court has compulsory jurisdiction, like what is called the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, there is a provision there that the International Court of Justice has compulsory jurisdiction. Okay, so that's why in the case of Germany, Legrand. Okay, so Legrand was two brothers who were arrested, I believe, in Arizona for murder. According to the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, the Arizona government was supposed to have notified these German citizens that they could have access to the consulate for legal advice. They weren't provided that. So one was executed already. The second was about to be executed. And Germany filed a case in the International Court of Justice in 1999 called the Legrand case.
Hmm.
Okay. The United States had to show up because it's in the treaty. 2007, the United States withdrew from the treaty that the court has compulsory jurisdiction on consular relations. That is an indicator of realism. The United States is looking for its own self-interest. Yeah. So I'm not saying that that the world operates on realism. No, actually, it's the United States and a few others. Actually, there is a bunch of countries that make up a caucus within the United Nations called the Non-Aligned Movement. Okay. And these countries don't try to side. They're non-aligned. Yeah. So you still have that phenomenon taking place at the international level that clearly indicates not everybody operates on this realist theory. Yeah. So again, we cannot use a brush and do a broad stroke, oh, this is international relations. It can get very complicated.
So being that America has withdrawn compulsory jurisdiction from the ICJ, what are the implications of that for the work that you do on behalf of the Acting Council of Regency?
Well, the issue I pretty much want to focus on political science, yeah, and what we're doing here, because the problem that I see, and I've been teaching at the university since 2001, there is so much misinformation out there, yeah, that I felt that the place to address that misinformation is, where did that misinformation come from? And it all tends to come from the university. So when people go to take classes, they go out into the community. So I can't say the source of misinformation came from Hanalei, but it may have come from Joe Kealoha from Hanalei that took classes at UH that taught him this particular version. You know, 9 out of 10 chances. That 9 out of 10 chances. That's what it is.
That's what happened.
Yeah. So at the university is where the issue has to be resolved. So for myself and Lawrence and others that have been that are at the university, did you know that we're actually, when I started this back in 2001, when I entered the political science department to get my master's degree specializing in international relations, I knew what was being taught because I got my bachelor's degree there back in 1987. So I know that. I took those classes. And those classes were wrong. You know, a lot of it was blame the Haole for everything, blame the missionary, and get angry. Well, I was there. Been there, done that.
Mm.
It didn't explain anything. It just said get angry.
Got you angry.
Just get angry. And I was born in 1964. I wasn't even born in 1893, so I don't even know what happened in 1893, other than what somebody told me what happened. And then I found out what that person told me was not necessarily evidence-based, but was all emotional. And then from that emotion, I get emotional. We all get emotional. Then we find out nobody has explained exactly what happened yet until, you know, we all get through with our anger. So I looked at my anger that I went through back then in 1987 as a learned behavior. I wasn't angry because I knew what went on. I was angry because what I was taught. So when I went back to the University of Hawaii, I knew I was going to be engaging that issue. And I can tell you, I was not well-liked when I entered the University of Hawaii because I just came from the Permanent Court of Arbitration in the Netherlands that fully recognized the Hawaiian Kingdom as a state, because I was part of arbitration proceedings. If we weren't recognized as a state, we wouldn't have had arbitration proceedings to begin with. But I realized that our people back home didn't know this. So the focus was on education. Now, the reason why we don't know this information is because there was a process, a policy initiated formally in 1906, Department of Education, called the Program for Patriotic Exercises. So my grandparents' generation were basically brainwashed. And I had the pamphlet. And all you learn is American presidents, Yankee Doodle Dandy, God bless America.
Broad-based American indoctrination.
But under international law, a specific term for that is called attempts to denationalize the inhabitants of an occupied territory. That's a war crime. Okay? That Germany was prosecuted for.
Denationalization is a war crime.
Yeah, denationalization. Actually, it's part of the Nuremberg trials.
Yeah, that's what the German, the Nazi occupying government, I mean, the Nazi government tried to do in some of the occupied territories during World War II. Poland, for example, I think Luxembourg, some other parts of neighboring European countries that they occupied, where they were trying to not just occupy them militarily, but kind of permanently make them part of the German Empire, and completely, like, either, like, you know, probably kill half of the populations at the concentration camps, but those that they left there, they were trying to kind of Germanize them, just, like, make them lose their identity, let's say, as Polish, for example, and just make them into Germans. And
this was in the schools. These are children.
Now, so international, and that would be applicable back to those days, too.
Yeah, actually, the United States recognized attempts to denationalize inhabitants of an occupied territory as a war crime. So it's clear.
Yeah, that was one of the charges.
That was one of the charges.
At the Nuremberg trials for
actually, in Nuremberg trial, one of the charges was called Germanization. Mm-hmm. That's called attempts to denationalize. And Nazis were prosecuted. Also, Italians were prosecuted. Because Italians, which were in World War II, actually were prosecuted for war crimes because they attempted to Italianize children in the schools in Yugoslavia in World War II.
So that's international law, World War II. Is there an intertemporal kind of analysis that needs to be dealt with to apply that back to the Hawaiian situation?
Yeah, what would be exactly applicable at the time of the overthrow and during that period of ours that we could latch onto and say, hey, this is still applicable to today?
Okay. Now, first of all, war crimes were not a part of international law until after World War I. Okay, so 1893 is... We're not talking war crimes, okay? So international law by 1893 has already gone through what is called positivism, putting things down. So a lot of publicists were writing, what is a state?
Yeah.
What is sovereignty? You know, because prior to that, in the 1700s, you would have an international law called the law of nature that applies. The superiority of a monarch, the sovereign. But it gradually was taken away from the monarch and reduced to writing. And that's when people start to write and state, well, what is international law? Let's not think of it in a theory. Let's see it in written form. And that's what moved on the creation of treaties. So in 1893, the laws of war and occupation were pretty much had begun to be codified by the first one to have codified the laws of war, okay, which is really interesting, that was recognized by Europe, was a guy named Lieber. Okay, Lieber established what is called the Lieber Code during the Civil War, so that when the Union Army goes into the southern states, they apply the laws of occupation and the laws of war. Berlin, the Berlin Conference in 1870s and other places began to adopt the Lieber Code into making a code for Europe. Okay, so it became an accepted what is called custom. It was customary international law. They knew exactly what the law of occupation was, that when you go into another country and you overthrow the government and you're occupying it, you are mandated to administer the laws of the occupied state. Okay, that is a custom. That's customary international law. 1893, that was already recognized as custom. Okay. Now, during the breakout of the Spanish-American War in 1898, it was still custom, right? And President McKinley even issued a presidential order on administration of American law in Spanish territories. What is a military government? He's laying it out.
McKinley?
I got that. Yeah, I got that proclamation.
He just forgot to make the proclamation about Hawaii.
Well, it was supposed to apply to Hawaii, but it was applied to all occupied territories during the Spanish-American War.
Wow.
Now, 1899 comes around. The countries are coming together, called together by Tsar Nicholas II, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tsar Nicholas from Russia convenes all these countries because war is not illegal under international law. Actually, war is legal at that time. It still is if it's self-defense. International law regulates war. It doesn't outlaw it at that time. It regulates it. So they got together in The Hague, which is a city in the Netherlands, and they're going to discuss the codification of customary international law, which led to the creation of the Hague Conventions of 1899. Okay. And the first Hague Convention, Hague Convention number 1, was establishing the Permanent Court of Arbitration as a means to resolve disputes between states so they don't go to war. But if they still go to war, then Hague Convention number 2 and 3 will apply. Now, the Hague Conventions then were superseded because the countries got together again in The Hague in 1907. So what you have there from 1907 called the Hague Convention is merely a codification of customary international law of the 19th century, evidenced by the United States during the Spanish-American War.
Yeah.
And the Hague Convention of 1907 still applies today. Hague Convention number 4 applies to occupied territory. And then that was added. What was added to that was the certain aspects of the Hague Convention were not fully covering everything, and it became evident during World War II. So what they did was, instead of changing the Hague Convention,
they made the Hague rules.
No, they met together in Geneva in 1949 and created the Geneva Conventions, which address all those issues that were not taken up in the Hague Convention. So that's why if you're in the Army, like I'm a retired captain, if you're in the Army, the laws of war and occupation, okay, actually include the 1907 Hague Conventions and the 1949 Geneva Conventions, and possibly the additional protocol of 1977. Those are what we call the laws of occupation, the laws of war, which is a codification of customary international law that had already existed before.
So the Geneva Conventions were a further codification of what had been customary prior to that, but
I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example of the Geneva Convention. Article 147 of the Geneva Convention number 4, dealing with occupied territories. That's the fourth Geneva Convention. It addressed what could not be taken up by the Hague Convention during World War II with regard, in this case, to Germany. Germany was occupying territories like France, Luxembourg, Norway, Sweden, even parts of Russia at that time.
Not Sweden. Sweden was neutral.
So just Norway, yeah?
Norway,
or Finland too?
Finland, I'm not sure, but Norway for sure.
So when Germany was occupying territories, in certain cases, Germany was imposing their own laws within these territories. That's a violation of the sovereignty of these countries. They're supposed to administer the laws of the occupied state, not their own laws. Through that process, Germany was creating courts, their own courts, let's say in occupied France. And these German judges were operating under German law in French territory, thus creating extrajudicial proceedings, which led to executions and so forth. There's nothing in there that specifically addressed in the Hague Convention unfair trials.
Wow.
That became a provision of Article 47, which now recognizes it as a war crime, where you deprive somebody, a protected person, of a fair and regular trial. Okay. And that very issue came up in the Geneva Convention on a fair and regular trial with regard to Guantanamo Bay. So the military commissions that were created in Cuba by the Bush administration, there was actually a public defender who was an army guy, okay, a military public defender, representing this guy Hamdan, okay, who claimed, I guess he was like a driver what's his name?
Osama bin Laden.
Bin Laden. Yeah, he's like a driver. Okay. The public defender appealed, made a complaint, and it was appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. He was saying that the tribunals in Guantanamo Bay are illegal because Guantanamo Bay is within U.S. territory because it's a military base. It's a military base.
And with that, it takes us to the top of the hour. We want to again thank our guests here, Dr. Kim Tsai, Lorenz Gonshore. Hey, I got that one. Shane Cobb Adams, all the way from Anohola. Mr. Bob Sitkoff from Atlanta, Georgia. Top of the hour, this is Nalia Hawaiian Issues. Very interesting discussion going on right here. And just to let you know, the phones are up. The phones are up. Thank for Dean coming in. The phones are up, so you can give us a call if you have any questions or you want to bring up something else, an issue, 826-7771 or 826-774. Again, Nalia Hawaiian Issues is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Kamoa Ukulele and KCC, Kauai Community Radio.
Kamoa Ukulele Company, dedicated to building high-quality bell-tone instruments, built with one player at a time philosophy, from student models up to custom masterpieces. Kamoa Ukulele Company, a family-owned business, supports KKCR, 652-9999 or online at kamoaukulelecompany.com.
The Hawaiian Studies Program at Kauai Community College, offering courses and experiences in Hawaiian language and culture for the children and friends of Hawaii. 245-8202.
Hello, we're back on air. Thank you. On Mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. We have Dr. Keanu Tsai, Mr. Lorenz Gonshore, Shane Cobb Adams, and Bob Sitkoff. And I think we got our other person on the line over here, Ms. Mahilani Silva. Hello, Kaz, are you over there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. This is Mahilani Silva,
hey,
people.
Hello, Mahilani.
Hi, everyone.
Phone's
thank you again for joining us. I'd just like to let everybody know that one of the things ever since the 90s, when people started coming out, Kauai, Hawaii, lawful reinstated government in terms of the sovereignty movement. And then also, Kauai Tsai, you started coming out as acting regents. And one of the things that I've, throughout all, first of all, many of the various different sovereignty initiatives have engaged in changing or adding on to the laws and the statutes. And if we look at that carefully in an international arena, that would make all those entities the same as a provisional government. You have not done as such. Also, the things that you've come across, and it's through academic research, the facts that you've put forward and you've proceeded, you've been consistent and presenting that, especially you were one of the first who brought out the similarities in terms of the occupations of Estonia, Latvia, and I forget the other one, Lithuania. So, again, and you've been consistent in presenting that. Now many others are presenting it as well. I think it's because basically you have achieved something through education at the university that has inspired others to come forth. But again, a lot of times people take that information and tweak it a little bit. But you have continued to be, and I hope so, you have continued to stay your course and delve deeper into the academia in order to present the facts at hand. And I only wish I could have attended last night, but I've been keeping close tabs online. Now, one of the questions that many people do still have in terms of the truth and where is it going and what are we going to do, you're presenting academia research to assist us in Hawaiian's independence, but first you've got to dispel the myths that have cropped up, that have been taught in the university. So what do we need to do as individuals, and you've said this before in the program, education is key. What do we need to do, and what do we need to focus on the community at large? The community at large wants to know, what can they do? What's their part?
And then after this, we have another caller that wants to ask a question, too.
Well, I think, those are very good points you're bringing up, Mahelani. And yes, education is crucial, but I'm not saying education is the end game. Actually, education is the means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
When people begin to get educated in certain areas, let's say I'm an attorney, and I learned this at the university, I'm taking classes, let's say I've written a law journal article where it has gone through law review, they're critiquing it, it gets published, and it addresses the fact that the United States is legally not here. How does that affect the courts here? So if it's legally not here, then the courts here don't have jurisdiction. How do I now present an argument being a good attorney under Rule 12b1, subject matter jurisdiction?
Subject matter jurisdiction.
So what you have there is somebody then, and I know it's not just one, but attorneys are already doing that. And what's interesting is when they argue the cases in court and they provide the pleadings, it's actually very unemotional. They're just saying procedurally, this court doesn't exist, and here are all the court cases that reaffirm that. So it kind of throws everyone off, because now people are coming from an educated standpoint and not from a cultural, from a native. I mean, you have people that are not even native Hawaiian who are attorneys who are bringing these issues up in criminal cases. It brings the issue where the rubber meets the road. Yeah. Other cases of at the educational level, you have teachers that go through the College of Education to get certified to teach in the Department of Education, and they learn this. So they may have taken my class or other classes that speak to this issue, and they realize it's, wow, this is for real. And then in order for them to be a better teacher, they need to teach this history. But how do you teach this history without looking like you're being political? Be historical. Just teach it. So when people through education begin to normalize the conversation and not radicalize the conversation is crucial. Because when people can start to talk to each other is when you can actually have conversations. When people start to talk at each other, nobody's conversing. Everybody's trying to prove their point. And that's why it's everyone will know what they have to do through education. It doesn't apply equally across the board. Everyone will know what they need to, like, for
me. The truth becomes self-evident at some point. You know, when you say normalize, it might be better to kind of expand that normalized definition to living it.
Okay, so back in 2001 is an example. 2001, I'm explaining Hawaii's occupied, that it was only the government that was illegally overthrown, not the state. Okay, now that was going against the grain of people saying before, no, Hawaii was colonized. Yeah, and we have to be decolonized as opposed to be deoccupied. To be colonized and occupied are two different things. Okay, colonization is an extension of the sovereignty of one country over the territory of another that is not a country yet. Okay, that's called a colony. And then in order for that non-state entity, which is part of the colonized entity, the colonizer, they need to decolonize to become their own country. That's the process called self-determination. So an example of self-determination is Gandhi with India. Okay, India was not a recognized sovereign state when it was colonized. But it was a recognized sovereign state, I believe, 1947, when it was decolonized and it became a full independent state. What it did was it exercised self-determination. Now, when you occupy a territory, what you're doing is you're occupying another state. You're not colonizing another state. So when the United States went into Japan and occupied Japan after World War II, from 1945 to 1952, General MacArthur there was the military governor.
They weren't colonizing
Japan. They were occupying Japan and administering Japanese law.
Right.
Not American law.
Exactly.
In a colony, you administer the laws of the colonizer, right? And then when you decolonize, then you have your own law. That's what's called independence. So people have always said, back in 2001, Hawaii was colonized by the United States, and we need to be decolonized, which reinforced the so-called sovereignty movement. So you have a movement towards sovereignty, assuming you're not sovereign yet. You're trying to get it. So everybody has their own way on how to get it.
So does that make it a movement away from the true sovereignty?
It just makes it a movement that is not relevant to our situation because Hawaii never lost its sovereignty. It's occupied. So we need to understand not how do we get sovereignty, but how do we exercise sovereignty that was never lost within the construct of occupation? See, that's when you start to have to learn this other game. So you might say we've been playing football using baseball rules. Okay. Now we're starting to realize what are football rules. Oh, now we can come up with a play. But you need to be educated on what are the terms and definitions of football. But I still hear people talk about football and then in a sentence still throw a home run in there, yeah, and still throw out a strike. Now you're convoluting the two.
We need to decolonize ourselves, or we need to deoccupy the nation, and that starts with self-determination.
Right. And at that, if I may, we'll put the caller on because you've been waiting. Thank you so much for waiting, caller. You're on the air.
Hi, aloha.
Aloha.
Hi. Oh, I want to thank everyone that put this program together here. Naleo Issues is one of the most important programs on KKCR, in my opinion. And I want to thank you again, Kiana Sai, for coming to Kauai and giving us so much information last night at the meeting. And by the way, whoever put the food together there last evening, very, very ono. Thank you.
Thank you, Kalai.
It's interesting that back in 1998, Keanu Sai was a speaker at our first Aloha March to Washington, D.C. They, Butch Kekahu and Mikala and Kavika, organized it because the sovereignty issue was just rearing its head publicly, and there was no way to get the good information out. So they put together this Aloha March, the first one, in 1998 in Washington, D.C. It was fabulous. So many people came there from all over the country. And Keanu Sai was our first speaker the very first night we arrived. So I was privileged to get a lot of this information from you, Keanu, even though maybe you probably would say, well, you didn't have all the information at that time and you have much more. Would you probably say that?
Well, actually, here's an interesting anecdote real quick. A person that sits on my doctoral committee, I sit on this person's doctoral committee at the University of Hawaii, his PhD committee, and he said that he saw a video by Namako Kaina at a Sinclair Library at the University of Hawaii. Okay. And he said, it said, Hawaiian Kingdom Law, Keanu Sai.
What year?
1998. Okay. And it was 4 hours long. So my friend, who is my doctoral student, but he's my friend, he says, Keanu, I had to go and get that and go watch it. So he watched it, and he saw me in Hilo giving a presentation on Hawaiian Kingdom Law and Hawaii's history. Instead of using a PowerPoint, I'm using transparencies with an overhead projector on a screen.
Those before PowerPoint.
1998.
Right.
So he tells me, he says, what's amazing, Keanu, is everything you said back in 1998 is everything you're saying now, except now you have letters after your name called a PhD. So he says, you've been very consistent, because I remember that presentation that I gave, or that speech that I gave at Washington, because I was good friends with Butch. Actually, Butch asked me if I could be one of the speakers. I said, hey, not a problem. And what I did was I was pointing out the difference between a treaty and a joint resolution of annexation, and why a joint resolution is not a treaty and it didn't annex anything. And that was 1998. Because we actually came out with Namako Kaina. We had a video called We Are Who We Were. And it's a 15-minute video that actually addresses that particular issue, which we produced with Namako Kaina as part of education. So I've been pretty consistent. But what I can say is what I have now is a deeper knowledge of the information, because I'm a political scientist now. But as far as the historical facts, they're still the same. But I can really now articulate the issues which I actually grew as a trained group, came about as a trained political scientist.
Yeah. Well, you are very, very much appreciated, and so is KKCR. Without our radio station, we would never have gotten the word out about the Aloha marches, and that was all up to Butch and his family. And now every week with this program on, it's fabulous. And I just want to say how much we appreciate all that you've done to bring this information to us. And I was hoping, Shane, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I was hoping that, you know, you're advertising that there's going to be more meetings. That's fabulous. I have a couple suggestions, that you try to find venues that have real chairs rather than benches. Yeah, people are not very comfortable on benches for 3 hours. And like you said, we had a lot of people there, and they stayed because the information was so valuable to them. And I was hoping that your meetings could be held on different parts of the island to make it accessible to, like, the Westsiders and the North Shore folks particularly.
Yeah, we're thinking about going on the road. I believe Tim Reese is putting up a GoFundMe site, because at this point we're just working on donations of a core group of five or six individuals. And so we're at Wilcox because they offer that facility for free at this point. But as the numbers grow, we're looking at doing Halawai Kuokoas around the island. And we'll continue at this point. I believe we've committed to do at least five or six more, one per month.
And to let you know, I know these guys that have a show, KKCR, every 11 to 1 on Saturdays. They can help you out, too, anytime you like. You give us a call.
All right.
Excellent. Thanks again. Much, you guys. Really, you are appreciated.
Mahalo, Auntie.
Mahalo.
Because you, Shane, you had the meeting with Donovan Preza.
Yes.
And he brought up the same point, too. Again, it is knowledge. I learned, too, about the three processes and how we're using, you don't use indigenous, don't use colonization because of what those actually, you know, those pathways are not the correct way.
Right.
It is deoccupation.
Right.
So, going on that theme, what do you see as where do we go now? How do we get that what we want, which is our sovereign nation?
Well, again, we're not seeking our sovereign nation. It already exists. We're occupied.
We just want to get it working.
No, we just want to... How do we exercise our rights through Hawaii sovereignty within the laws of occupation? And that presents another aspect of education in that, well, what is the occupier supposed to do? And what are the occupied supposed to do? You know, it's a process. It's not a one-way street. But once people understand what their rights are, then they understand what the system exists, and then they know how to address or redress injuries. Because once you approach this through the law of occupation, Hawaii being an independent state, you can access international realm, or the international realm, where independent states, even occupied, can access. You know, so you have Security Council, you have the International Criminal Court, you have the Human Rights Committee, Human Rights Commission in Geneva. You have the European Court on Human Rights. I mean, there are so many venues out there that we wouldn't have been able to access without us knowing that we are who we were in order for us to access. So that's why my recommendation is, I don't tell people where we need to go, but I think it's important for people to know where we're at. And in order to know where you're at, you need to know how you got to where you're at. You know, it's like if you're in the mountains and you took off and you got lost, the one thing you don't do that I learned in land nav in the Army, you don't keep walking forward. What you're supposed to do is walk backwards to find a known point that you can identify. Okay? And then you normally sit there and wait until somebody finds you. Because if you keep going into the mountains because you think you know where you're going, you're going to get lost.
Yeah.
So that's...
Well, and there's a lot of that going on. The idea that education is the key to understanding your rights, I think, is important, because what we're really looking for in deoccupying or ending the occupation or beginning the deoccupation is compliance.
Comply to the law of occupation.
And you can't know what to comply to unless you know what your rights are and what the situation is.
Well, put it in a real time. Like, for example, I know some of my cousins and myself, as far as the Hmong seals, And also for me, where I live, there's a sanctuary for the albatross. Now, my family lives there for centuries. We go, never bother them, they never bother me. But there is a law of the United States that says that's a sanctuary and keep out. Whether I'm wrong or right in your eyes, or I'm not too sure, but I exercise my right. It's like, you're not going to tell me I can go where I've always gone. So you have that law, but I'm telling you that law is not playing to me. So I'm exercising my right to go down. I know some of my other cousins too. They're going fishing and everyone's, hey, don't go in there to this monk seal. They're like, don't talk to me about no monk seal. I'm a Hawaiian going. I'm not bothering him. You're not bothering me. Don't tell me nothing. We're exercising that way. Is that the right way? Is there some way, unless we get arrested, then we can go to those other avenues that would protect us?
Well, what I recommend is don't get arrested.
Yeah, I don't like. I'd rather be, you know, watching TV rather in a jail.
Okay, so Randy, what I heard you say is the actions that I heard you say is not one of compliance, but one of defiance.
Yes.
Yeah, you're defying what this is upon what I believe I'm going to do.
Right.
Okay. I don't push defiance. In Hawaiian, it's called ku'e. Ku'e, power ready. Don't go for defiance, go for compliance. So what is that law, and how does that law apply under the laws of occupation, and whether or not it's legal? See, that's, now you're going to venture into trying to understand what's going on and not digging in your heels. So when you say, wait a minute, this law is an American law created by Congress. Hawaii's not part of the United States. Congress is limited to U.S. territory. Wait a minute, that law doesn't even apply here. Can the law apply during occupation? No, Hawaiian Kingdom law. I think I have an issue here. Let me try find an attorney who knows this area that could possibly I can retain to address this issue. Then what you're doing is you're going through a process of compliance and the rule of law. What I don't encourage is people to defy. You know, because when you defy something,
we're going to get arrested.
Well, it may not serve anything but you getting arrested, you know. And true. But this way, you can address that. So here's an approach that I take, and I learned this from the Army. Okay, so if you approach an obstacle, right, or a perceived obstacle, you can actually, you have three choices to address that obstacle, right, or perceived obstacle. You can walk around it because it's irrelevant, right, it's not a threat. You can blow it up because you need to breach it so you can get through it. Or you can use it to your advantage and reframe it. Okay. In my experience, I have never blown up any obstacles. Most of the time, I just walk around it. A few times, I like to reframe it. In this case, you're looking at the law. I'm not going to defy. Let's see how I can play with it. Let's try to find somebody who can explain to me about this and not rely on what I think about it. See, then that leads to education. So the education got you to the point to find out who knows this, who's educated on it, who can use it in a court, or who can use it in a proceeding, or whatever the case may be. Compliance is important, because under the laws of occupation, there is a rule of law, that says the occupied people have temporary obedience. Okay, that's in the law of occupation. Temporary obedience to the occupier. So long as the occupier is following the laws of occupation, though. Temporary obedience. Not allegiance. Allegiance is to the laws of the country. Obedience is to comply. But you only comply if the occupier is complying with the law himself. So there may be an instance of defiance, but that defiance is leading toward compliance.
Okay, so for example, let's give an example here, because I have an example I'm interested in. Because I know you hunt and dive a lot, or, you know, used to more before you started doing political science thing, Kiana. But as a kid growing up on Kauai, I never seen a single monk seal. And monk seals do not appear in the Kumulipo. And there's good evidence that a couple harbor seals were dropped off here a couple hundred years ago and became what people think is the native Hawaiian monk seal, but it's not native. It's the Ilioke Kai, the dog of the sea. And so when I go diving now, my nets get accosted by monk seals. And so there's a growing kind of thing amongst the fishermen and diving community that we need to kill the monk seals and get rid of them because they're eating our refrigerator clean. So being that the Hawaiian Kingdom doesn't have a law protecting monk seals or making it illegal or a $10,000 fine to kill them, would a fisherman protecting his catch, killing a monk seal who was stealing his catch, how does that fit into allegiance
and obedience. So the allegiance is to the Hawaiian kingdom, but the, being that the state of Hawaii and the government here is not implementing Hawaiian kingdom law, which doesn't have a law against killing monk seals, where does the fisherman defending his catch fall in terms of allegiance to state law that says monk seals are protected and it's a $10,000 fine?
Well, not allegiance to state law, obedience to law, but the question is the state law legal, which would ensure obedience?
Mm.
You don't...
So that's just no
there. You're not obedient to something illegal. The issue of the rule of obedience is only when the occupier is complying to the law of occupation in the administration of the laws of the occupied state. That's when it kicks in. So it's not like...
Well, currently they are not.
Well, if you're going to talk about the monk seal and what people will do or not do, I mean, you can also apply that to the mongoose out here. You know, the mongoose came to try to get rid of the rats in the sugar cane, but I guess somebody didn't realize that the rats come out at night and the mongoose come out during the
daytime.
Day. Yeah, so that's a big point. That actually happened, though. So we got a lot of mongoose running around. You know,
except Kauai, no more mongoose.
No, and then outside we get tapir, you know, the fish. That was introduced. So we have to deal with these issues because that's just how things have to be dealt with. But what are the rules that apply? So let me step back and explain to you what is the basis of the law of occupation. Mm. As it stems from international law. The cornerstone of the law of occupation is to administer the laws of the occupied state.
The Hawaiian kingdom.
Whoever that occupied state is.
But Iraq, in our case, it's
Japan. Any state that is occupied, the laws of that country, in this case, Hawaiian kingdom law that existed in 1893. That's just the way it works. Now, the purpose of the law of occupation is to maintain the status quo of the occupied state because all occupations are supposed to be temporary. Not permanent, because you're dealing with sovereignty. You're dealing with independence. So if it's maintaining the status quo, the occupier is not supposed to change anything within the occupied territory that was there before the occupation began.
Okay.
That's the key. And that includes the economy. That includes the territory. That includes the laws. You can't change things. You got to maintain it. So if you're maintaining the status quo of what the Hawaiian kingdom was, one example would be the cost of living right now. The cost of living is not really connected to the Hawaiian kingdom economy. It's actually connected to the United States economy because of the violation of the laws of occupation. So we have a problem there. So how do you bring that in line with what the economy was? So in order to know what we need to do today, we need to know what actually it was before the occupation. Not just the laws, the economy, the cost of living, you know, the citizenry. What were those laws back then? Did they apply to monk seals or not? You know, is there a custom in Hawaiian kingdom law that could deal with... Let me see, all those issues would have to be looked into first before a fisherman starts killing off monk seals and then the feds are going to come in and arrest them for violating a federal law, you know, whatever the case may be. My recommendation is, as people get educated, also that education should provide that person the ability to seek out others who have already been educated in particular areas that can address these issues. That's what I advocate. And that's why education is at the foundation of everything. But it doesn't mean everybody needs to know what everybody knows. Education is to just learn and to move forward. If anything, what I see, and I shared last night, what I promote through education is that it maximizes responsibility. It maximizes kuleana. Okay, so Rodney, I'm going to use you as an example. Okay, so you're learning about this information. How does it apply to you as a radio broadcaster? What it would be is you need to be a better radio broadcaster that addresses issues to provide information to the greater public. Yeah, so you would know how to discern between certain terminology. So you become that voice of reason. Yeah, so you become a better radio broadcaster. If I'm a police officer, what happens now when I find out that all these laws are illegal? How do I still maintain and protect the community from drug dealers, from murderers? Is there a way to do this under the law of occupation through what I've learned called the doctrine of necessity? There are ways to do that. In fact, I've been talking to police officers on a Big Island about this. So it's how does each person play into this? If I'm a judge, okay, let's say I'm a judge, and I come across this information that I cannot deny. I've taken classes, I've written law journal articles, whatever the case may be. How do I be a better judge? I just realized that I'm not really a judge because the state of Hawaii was created by Congress, which is limited to U.S. territory. But I'm still sitting on a bench looking at an alleged murderer. Do I just say, he's out of here? No, that's irresponsible. The judge would have to then say, well, how do I get jurisdiction to address this issue without committing the war crime of an unfair trial that could haunt me later? And there's a necessity issue there. And these are the kind of things that I cover in my writings, my doctoral dissertation. The key is not to exacerbate the problem. The key is how do you provide a solution to this problem? But before you can provide a solution or what is called a prescription, you got to understand what happened. You might say we've been misdiagnosed. You know, it's like we've been kidnapped by the United States, but we've been treated like we was adopted. But we can't find adoption papers. Then that means you're still kidnapped.
I like that analogy.
Yeah. You know. Can you, General, can you give your website address on the UH server for your dissertation? Because I think a lot of people out there who are interested in these questions of where to go should read Chapter 5 of your dissertation, because there's a lot of good information there for Hawaiian nationals and interested people alike.
Well, you know, real quick, the best way to do it is go to Google and type in Dr. Kianosai, and you'll go to my UH website. It's called www.hawaii.edu. When you see hawaii.edu, go to that, go to publications, and you can download my law journal articles, my dissertation, and just happy reading.
And with that, we're at the bottom of the hour again, having a very good discussion with Dr. Kianosai, Lorenz Gonshur, Shane Cobb Adams, and Bod Sivkoff from Atlanta. And got to do that stuff at the half hour, which is you are listening to KKCR Hanalei KQA Kilauea, and this is Nalea Hawaiian Issues. Let's see what's happening with the ocean safety today, because the waves are big. Watch out.
Aloha, I'm Pat Durkin with your KKCR Beach and Ocean Safety Tip for today. The safest places to swim are at beaches with lifeguards. On Kauai, we have 7 lifeguard stations.
Are you there?
On the North Shore, they are located at Haiana Beach Park and the Hanalei Pavilion. On the East Side, lifeguards are at Kailia Beach Park and Lydgate Park. South to West Side locations are Poipu Beach Park, Salt Pond Park, and Kekaha Beach Park. These stations are staffed 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Always check in with lifeguards no matter where you plan to swim. Conditions can change rapidly. For more information about today's ocean conditions on Kauai, visit kauaiexplorer.com. With today's beach and ocean safety tip, I'm Pat Durkin for KKCR Radio. Have fun and be safe.
So what's happening today? There's high
Pico
surf warnings.
Business Solution, oh. Hawaii's copy systems supplier, sales, lease, and service of...
No, not yet. So the high surf warning for north and west-facing shores, dangerous all north and west-facing shores, which means there's high surf from Kekaha, Napali, all the way down, looks around to Kilauea, Hanalei, Haena, 30 to 40 feet, which means if you don't know what you're doing, no go in the water. From Kailia down to around Salt Park, you're looking at about 2 to 3, and then Kekaha, you jump back up to 15 to 25. General rule, if you don't see brown people in the water, no go. We're not there for a reason, okay? Be safe. We don't want to see you on the news. See you around town. And again, I want to bring back to our discussion with Shane Cobb Adams. Bob, if you had any questions, you've been mighty quiet over there. And we have Dr. Kianosai and Lorenz Gonshur will be joining back with us. We're back on air, gentlemen.
All right.
And Cuz on the phone. Oh, you know,
yes,
actually, Cuz, whenever we get a phone call, we kind of like jump on them because, you know, I hear my cousin every week, yeah. You know, so I'll hear someone else. Yeah. Okay, so hello, caller. You're on the air with Nalea Hawaiian Issues.
Hi.
Hey. Do you want to go on air?
Yes, please.
Okay, you are.
Aloha.
Hey, hello, everybody.
Aloha.
Hi, aloha. Very good meeting last night, Ken. Appreciate everything. I've spent the last couple of years, I just recently moved back home from the mainland. I spent the last couple of years going to YouTube and listening to everything you have to say. And I also am glad that you're sticking to your guns because the research is just so awesome. I have a question regarding Liko Martin's filing with the UN. Are you familiar with that?
No. But I know Liko Martin, but I don't know what he filed.
Yeah, see, he filed a petition to the UN on the grounds of genocide. And it's on his webpage, legalmartin.org. And so I was hoping you would probably know something about that. I think Leon Chu might have helped him with that. But, you know, Lico's been doing this for a long time, and he finally put this together. And I was hoping you would know something about it, because I don't really know the procedure for the filing to the UN, and I don't know what could transpire from it all. And I understand it's going to be read. I don't know how that comes about. I understand it's going to be read in June sometime. So I was trying to get some information on that.
Well, I can maybe speak to the procedure and not necessarily to the substance. Yeah, because I don't know what Lico submitted. If a private person, can submit or report, in this case, genocide. Genocide is a crime against humanity. Okay. Which is unlawful. It's called a peremptory norm. It's a term they use in international law, jus cogens. Now, if a private person is going to file something, they would have to file it, not with the United Nations in its entirety, but there is a human rights committee that addresses those things, and they're in Geneva. So private people can file cases or complaints with the human rights committee for investigation. So I'm assuming maybe that's what he did. And then they're looking.
Is it not like the Larson case a little bit?
No, the Larson case was very different. The Larson case was Lance Larson was put in jail for following Hawaiian law. And he was alleging that the acting government of the Hawaiian Kingdom was liable for negligence for allowing the unlawful imposition of Hawaiian law, which led to his incarceration. That was a dispute where he was trying to sue the acting government. That case was submitted to the Permanent Court of Arbitration to address the dispute because it's an international matter. Yeah. And when the case started in November of 1999, November 8th, I believe, it was filed, what the Permanent Court of Arbitration needed to do was to verify whether or not the Hawaiian Kingdom still exists as a state. Otherwise, it won't be able to create an arbitrational tribunal to address that dispute alleging negligence. Yeah. Because if a Hawaiian national is alleging the acting government of the Hawaiian Kingdom for negligence, that dispute right there is based upon the existence of the Hawaiian Kingdom as a state, the acting government as a viable, as a lawful government, and Lance Larson as a Hawaiian subject. So before they can get to the dispute between a government and a subject, they have to verify whether or not the Hawaiian Kingdom still exists. Because if the Hawaiian Kingdom doesn't exist, then there's no such thing as an acting government, as no such thing as a Hawaiian subject, Lance Larson. So from November until February, the Permanent Court of Arbitration was vetting this process, vetting the issue. And that's when I was approached by the secretary. I was asked by the Secretary General of the Permanent Court of Arbitration, which was created in 1899, to provide a formal invitation to the United States State Department in Washington, D.C. to join in the arbitration. For the Permanent Court of Arbitration, what that would signify is it would give the opportunity to the United States to disprove the existence of the Hawaiian Kingdom, because the Secretary General could not disprove the existence of the Hawaiian Kingdom. Because there is no international law or treaty or decision by any court that says the Hawaiian Kingdom doesn't exist. All you have is American laws passed by Congress that said they annexed Hawaii, they created the state of Hawaii, and before that they created the territory of Hawaii. Well, American laws have no effect beyond American borders, so the Hawaiian Kingdom is not affected by American laws. That's what the Secretary General realized, and they were shocked. So by providing an invitation to the State Department, if the Permanent Court of Arbitration can't deny the existence of the kingdom, then the United States surely must, they should be able to, because Hawaii supposedly is the 50th state. And when I had that meeting with that person from the Secretary of State, his name was John Crook. Okay, he was actually assigned from the Justice Department to the State Department.
John Crook?
Crook, yeah. How's that? That was his name. But, you know, John Crook was actually involved in international court proceedings at the International Court of Justice representing the United States. So he was the right guy to talk to. Mm-hmm. Okay. When I first mentioned to him that we're here because the Secretary General requested we provide an invitation to the United States to join in the arbitration, he says, "You're in the Permanent Court of Arbitration?" Because he knows only states can enter the Permanent Court of Arbitration, independent states. And I said, "Yeah." He went, "Whoa." And that's when he started to watch his P's and Q's, because he knew what was being played here. And we're basically going to call the bluff. If you can prove that Hawaii is the 50th state, step into the tribunal. Prove it. Don't tell it. And my meeting that I had with him, with Lance Larson's attorney, Ninia Parks, because we're the parties to the arbitration, we both agreed to provide formal invitation to the United States to join in. We called it. Now, I put everything in writing, because that was requested by me of the Secretary General of the court, and I sent it to the registry in the Netherlands that very same day by email, and I sent a copy to John Crook, so he knows what we talked about. Yeah. A few days later, the American Embassy in The Hague notified the court that they have no intention of joining the arbitration, and they're not stopping the arbitration. That was an indication to the Permanent Court of Arbitration the U.S. is not disputing the existence of the Hawaiian Kingdom as a state.
Because if they had wanted to dispute it, they could have come forth, participated, and provided contrary evidence.
Exactly. Show a treaty that Hawaii was annexed, and not a joint resolution of annexation, which is an American law. But they chose not to. And then, on top of that, it asked permission from the court, asked permission of us, Lance Larson and the acting government, for permission to access all records and pleadings and transcripts.
The Americans?
Yes, the U.S. Embassy, the embassy. So they not only, they did not dispute the existence of the Hawaiian Kingdom as a state, but they also provided direct recognition of the acting government for permission to access the pleadings. Okay, it was after that was done, then in April of 2000, the arbitrational tribunal was created to address this dispute of negligence.
And that's because the Permanent Court of Arbitration confirmed what they call the standing of the parties. So
yeah, they have to.
Lance Larson was confirmed as a Hawaiian national, and the Acting Council of Regency was confirmed as a representative
of the Hawaiian state.
Of the Hawaiian state.
Right. So
that's pretty I don't want to say revolutionary or fundamental, but I think that is at the core of what we talked about last night in terms of presumptive continuity.
Right. So the presumption of continuity is a principle of international law that once a state, despite your government being overthrown illegally or legally, but once a state, always a state, presumed to be a state until proven otherwise. So the entity that has to prove the kingdom doesn't exist is the United States. But the Hawaiian Kingdom does not have to prove it exists.
Yeah. But Carol, see, one of the, as you well know, one of the problems for Tanaka is, the old saying, patience is a virtue. Patience. All this stuff they have to prove. But when does it come about that they're going to do that? As well as they didn't step into the court to plead their side, they're not going to come forward to prove that they are.
No.
Patience.
Okay, I'm not advocating. I'm not advocating patience. Actually, what I say is ho'omanawanui. Now, ho'omanawanui does not mean patience. Ho'o is to do something. Manawa is time. Nui is plenty. So actually, ho'omanawanui means don't spin your wheels. So it's the counter of patience. So ho'omanawanui is don't waste your time on something where you might become tired when the real action needs to be done. So in what we've done throughout this process is we're testing the issue. Before you say I got it, you gotta go test fire. You gotta make sure that it works and not that somebody says, oh, it works. So what we're doing is we're testing what our kupuna already set in motion. Because prior to this, we're not using what they said. We've been operating on a false narrative that Hawaii was a part of the United States and we needed to be decolonized, or that we have a similar history to Native Americans. Nothing can be farther from the truth. Hawaii is its own country. So we needed to know who we were in order to know where we need to go.
Well, and I think that's critical, because while we were doing that and getting no progress, it's self-evident to me now that the reason we were getting no progress was because we didn't know who we are. We were using the wrong strategies. And we were acting confoolish, And so now I think in terms of patience of the people, it's only been since about 98. So what is that? 18 years since we've been applying the right, history, learning our mo'oku ahau legally, and beginning to develop strategies that are from a pro-Hawaiian, as opposed to anti-American foundation. And so in the grand course of things, we've only kind of started to do the right thing recently, I think.
Well, I think let me kind of just finish off what happened at the Permanent Court of Arbitration, because then you see where I've come from as far as education. I didn't just come up with education. It's a means to an end. Okay, so after the Permanent Court of Arbitration hearings, back in December, this was 3 days, we're contacted by the ambassador of Rwanda, who accessed the records at the court about the Hawaiian arbitration. Okay, and he wanted to meet with us in Brussels, Belgium. So he called us to meet, and I was the lead agent. So we caught the train to Brussels. We're picked up by the motorcade, about three cars from the Rwandan embassy. We're taken to a meeting that the ambassador had. We're with his assistant, and he was meeting with other ambassadors of Africa. Back then, it was called the Organization of African States, which came to be known today as the African Union, which is the counterpart to the European Union. Okay, so went to meet the ambassador in this meeting. He greeted us, and he excused himself from the meeting, from the rest of the ambassador, and says, please follow me. So we walked with him across this cobblestone road, across the street, to a little cafe. And this cafe was closed, that I found out later. Rwanda had bought it out for 2 hours, so nobody's in the cafe. He knocks on the door. The Belgian manager opens the door, greets him, lets us in. And we sit down. The door's locked. Shades are closed. And we have coffee. So I'm sitting in front of the ambassador. His name is Dr. Bio Zagawa. I actually have this event documented in one of my larger articles that if people can read in the publications of my website. So it was vetted. It was verified. Now, Dr. Bio Zagawa told me that his government has reviewed all the records of the case, and it is clear Hawaii's occupied, and that this cannot be tolerated. That's what he's telling me. And he says, Rwanda understands what happens when international law is violated, but the international community does not step in until it's too late. And he was making reference to the genocide. Right. So I guess we're tying it to Liko's case. Yeah. But referring to the genocide, now this Dr. Bio Zagawa, who's the ambassador, was a Tutsi, meaning he's a survivor of the genocide.
Oh.
Okay, that's why he was actually in the court across the hall at the International Court of Justice when our case was going on across the other side of the hall, because it was dealing with genocide against Congo, Belgium and Congo. That was a case that was going on when our case was going on. So he says to me that from his president through the foreign minister to him, he has been authorized to notify the acting government of the Hawaiian Kingdom that Rwanda is prepared to report to the United Nations General Assembly the prolonged occupation of Hawaii and bring it to an end. And I was like, wow, this is December of 2000. So I'm going, wow, you know, back home they think we're still crazy. This guy wants to take us to the next mountain. So I said, Your Excellency, please excuse me, I need to talk to my legal team. So I sat down with my legal team, we talked about it. I sat back down in front of the ambassador and I said, Your Excellency, please convey to your president our sincere gratitude, but we cannot accept this offer at this time. Our people back home have no clue of this profound status that Hawaii has as an independent state. We cannot allow Rwanda holding Hawaii up. Our people can't even stand on their own. We have to go home and begin re-education. Especially Rwanda would be the recipient of political retaliation by the United States because Hawaii is headquarters for the Pacific Command. This is military occupation. We need to do our homework. We may call you later, but our work is cut out for us. He thanked me. I said, no, thank you. Meeting came to an end. That was December of 2000. It was decided January, the very next month, 2001. Because I already had my degree from UH in 1987, my bachelor's, I know what they're teaching. I'm going to re-enter the University of Hawaii Political Science Department. I'm going to get a master's degree specializing in international relations and go head on with the misinformation and begin to change it from the inside out. And I knew my work was cut out for me, and I wasn't going to be well-liked. But I had an objective. I already came from The Hague. You can't tell me we weren't there. I know the kingdom exists. The problem is you don't know it. So now I'm going to use the academy to expose it. And I'm going to institutionalize this information, not politicize this information. And that's what led me to my PhD, my doctoral dissertation, my law journal articles, and encouraging others to research as well. So I'm glad to say I am not the only one that specializes in these areas, but we have people like Lawrence Gunscher. He's from Germany. He speaks French. He speaks German. He can access archival records in Belgium, in Germany, and other places throughout the world who had embassies and consulates of the Hawaiian Kingdom there, and he's finding some unbelievable things there. So we have other like Donovan Prezzo. We got Willie Kauai. We got Kamana Beamer. You know, this is not a Keanu thing. I may have been the tip of the spear, but everybody else is starting to take hold, and it also includes our community.
Well,
I look back now, what you said about holding back and educating, that was really important, because what it did was it sidestepped chaos. You know as well as I do that this place would have been a total turmoil. People would have been upset and, you know, vigilante stuff. So, I mean, thanks for the education. I mean, I really appreciate that. I've learned a lot. But I think we need to, I hope you have the time to look at Liko's page, LikoMartin.org, and look at links and goodies and find those documents, because he's written documents with cover letters to Senator Kerry, Governor Ige, all put them on notice. You know, Jewel from the DOI, and I think it's just, you know, the writing is profound, and I hope he gets it in there, and I hope it does something for us.
Cool.
And thank you for your time, your efforts, your education. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Mahalo for your call.
Well, I think, too, Keanu, one of the things that we all mahalo you for, especially since I've moved home back to Anahola, is that the amount of literature that's out there that allows the common everyday person to educate themselves. You don't have to be at the university anymore because of dissertations like Kamana Beamer and Willie Kauai.
And YouTube.
And YouTube, you know. YouTube videos are good, but I always recommend read the original source document. Get the references, understand it and own it. Because when we get our people up to the level of education that people can understand it on a daily basis and own it, then we can reach out to the international community, because we'll have an informed citizenry that can be responsible and hold itself up under and amongst the nations of the world.
Well, I think what's important is, I'm going back to the terminology. So I'm going to be upfront. And I would recommend that everybody needs to stop using these words with regard to Hawaii's history, because these are baseball rules in a football game. So I would say stop using self-determination. Self-determination only applies if you're not an independent state yet. That's what self-determination applies to.
Decolonization.
Stop decolonization. Stop colonization. Stop saying I'm colonized in the mind. No, just say you were brainwashed. You can measure that. When you say colonization of the mind, what does that mean? You know, so we need to get down to the nitty gritty. We need to identify what exactly is what, so that we don't necessarily need to understand it fully, but at least we have a baseline to understand it. Am I to the left? Am I to the right? Yeah. Am I right on target? We need starting points, you know, points.
Part of the challenge is that the American citizenry, you know, comparatively across the nations of the world, is some of the most ignorant citizenry around. And so 123 years of American indoctrination has really lowered the bar for what Hawaiians have experienced as what they need to do to be a contributing kind of valued member of the citizenry. You know, the basic, I go to, you know, foreign countries like France, Germany, you go throughout Europe, even China, the everyday person on the street, they know governance. They know how their system works. They understand their own history. And in America, it's, you know, one of the indicators is like Trump. Trump has actually said on his campaign tour, he loves uneducated.
Yeah, I saw that.
You see that? He loves uneducated.
That's the no-doubt one. He says a lot of things, yeah. But I have to ask you, gentlemen, I know you guys have a flight to catch, but, you know, we can go another hour, but Shane knows the traffic going back to town.
Oh, yeah, we might have to wrap this up.
Yeah, and I don't know if you're going to take on Hamura's, you know, or that kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah. So we were going to do another hour, but I think you, it's like I heard you guys like three or four.
Yeah, we got to wrap it up.
Yeah, that's going to be running.
But we are going to have continued Halawai Kuokoa over the next 6 months. We'll be coming out with a date for next month's Halawai. I believe we're looking at potentially having Umi Perkins, who has used some of Kiana's work, taught Hawaiian history, and is working on a dissertation. What's Umi's dissertation?
Well, actually, Umi has his PhD from political science, but Umi is an instructor at Kamehameha School's
Native Tamil
honored
rights,
history.
Huh?
He teaches honors history.
But his area of expertise in his dissertation was Native Tamil rights?
Yeah, land titles.
Land titles.
Native Tamil rights. Yeah.
So we're looking to have Umi Perkins and Kaho'o Kahi Kanuha, who's been kind of at the center of the TMT Mauna Kea controversy that's been going on.
You know, real quick, just to follow up before we come to a close here. Shane mentioned about people being knowledgeable in Europe about government, about things, meaning they're well-informed, they're educated. We need to use a baseline for us today. Okay, what was the Hawaiian Kingdom before the United States showed up and occupied Hawaii in 1898? Mm. Actually, Hawaii's literacy rate was nearly universal by 1890s. That means everybody could read and write.
98%.
In fact, King Kamehameha III said, "My kingdom is the kingdom of the Palapala." Palapala is called reading and writing. It's not just paper. It's reading and writing. Education was crucial because it was through education that Hawaii managed to transform itself in such a short time on government reform. People were educated. The schools were teaching it.
Well, and you can see that, too. If you read the newspapers at the time, the Hawaiian newspapers, you see, I mean, you see, you know, it's common citizens, like, writing commentary on the politics and, like, really, like, there's just one editorial, that, I mean, one letter to the editor that I found in 87, I think, 1887. I mean, like, mind-blowing kind of deep kind of international relations policy analysis, like, amazing. Like, he knows, like, all kind of, he knows the international arbitration that happened about the Alabama case and the Civil War.
Oh, Switzerland, yeah.
You know, I mean, and he applies that to, like, Hawaii's status in the world and, you know, like, the South Pacific, international power politics, like, these are like, and that's somebody I've never, the name I've never seen anywhere before or after. So it's obviously like some kind of just random common citizen of the kingdom making those kind of statements. So that tells you what kind of profound knowledge, what kind of profound interest in politics, not just national Hawaiian kingdom politics, but international politics that was going on there. And
okay,
through this American indoctrination that has the level has gone down. You know what I mean? That all of this has.
Okay, so here's Lawrence making a point. Identifying Hawaiians in the newspapers, Hawaiian subjects, natives and non-natives, speaking to a deep sense of understanding. Yeah, it's an indicator they're well informed. Okay, now that's looking at that. Now, what I also found was there was an article that was brought to my attention by my cousin Kauhi from Ho'olaupa'i. So she came across this newspaper article written in English by a reporter, I believe from South Dakota, who visited Hawaii in 1894. And he couldn't believe how well-informed the people were. And he said he walked past a grass hut, yeah, next to the shoreline, a grass hut, and he sees everybody in the grass hut reading newspapers. Everybody's reading papers. And he was like, wow. So it's almost like you have the grass hut, and you have newspapers, and you're in a constitutional monarchy. This is called a country called the Hawaiian Kingdom. That right there is an observation from somebody from the outside, and he was saying, you don't even see that in America. Yeah, exactly. You know, this is 1894. So our history is so, there's so much there to learn, but, you know, it's very empowering. It's like, wow, they knew what they were doing.
And he was having opihis and limokohu for lunch.
You know that. Well, I want to thank you, gentlemen, so much for stopping by. Lorenz Gonshard, Dr. Kiana Sai, Shane Cobb Adams. I know we're going to see you again, and
Cousin Kevin?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes,
yeah. Also, I would like to extend another invitation for Keanu to call in again, because, you know, the more people hear, the more educated they become, the more they're looking to research, and the more they're looking to educate themselves. I'd like to extend an invitation to Lorenz, because here in Hawaii, we have a lot of German Hawaiians.
I'm one of
my
them.
Family. Hawk. Yeah, Hawk is H-A-A-K-E from Bremen, Johann Hawk. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Eckhart family, the Campbell family, which is part of my family in Maui, too. So, I mean, and I know there's a big German community in Kauai. So, German-Hawaiian community. So, we'd like to extend an invitation to you as well as Shane. Cobb Adams, who I'm still checking my genealogy to see if we're cousins. But one of the things is I want to thank you so much, and I do extend the invitations because, as far as we're concerned, this information not only gets out here, but also gets out in the mainland to a lot of Kanakas who are listening in, and also here on Oahu and all over. So, again, mahalo nui for enlightening us, and continue to please, we extend the invitation for you to continue to enlighten us.
Mahalo.
Mahalo. And aloha no to all of you.
Hey, aloha.